Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Justin Wolfers from the University of Pennsylvania. Justin and I met in June 2009 at a conference of the Centre for Economic Performance in London. Justin had just presented a paper co-authored with Betsy Stevenson about inequality and happiness. But I began by asking him generally about the state of happiness economics, where the subject had got to.
It's gotten to an interesting place because you no longer have to justify the fact that you're interested in happiness. It's absolutely clear that non-economists are fascinated with happiness. We've all learned that. And economists increasingly are understanding it as a facet of well-being. We understand that some part of it is measurable. We're not sure how much. We understand that maybe it plays a role in the policy process. So there was a time, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, where giving a talk in a serious economics department saying you were interested in studying happiness, as soon as the laughter died down, you'd then have to do very simple things like say, well, this is how we measure happiness, by asking people how happy they are. Then you'd get all the usual objections. Well, surely people are just answering relative to some norm or something like that. And then you'd have to go back to sort of Psych 101 and explain what it is we know about the measurement of happiness. And so the first 45 minutes of your typical happiness talk was always the same thing. What the heck am I doing? Why am I doing it? And then finally getting to the social science, what the heck we just learned. Now, there's an enormous number of young social scientists around the world interested in measuring it, understanding it, evaluating it, trying to figure out how policies affect not only happiness but subjective well-being much more broadly. And so you can just much more efficiently assume a level of interest among fellow economists, and that level of interest among the broader population, I think, just continues to grow. The bestseller list always seems to have 2 or 3 popular books, often not written the way we economists would write them, but deeply informed by findings in social science. So it's also an opportunity to talk to the public in a way that we often don't have when we're thinking about some of the more arcane issues.
So how are we doing on data on happiness right now? I mean, what do we know about various kinds of measures of people's well-being, and how widely has that been collected?
I think we're at an extraordinary moment right now. Data has always been the biggest constraint, particularly for economists who are interested in looking at countries and time series, and this requires huge databases. Some of the most notable recent innovations, the Gallup World Poll. Gallup, a private sector organization, has done something no government or international organization has done. They're in the field every year in over 140 different countries, asking about not only people's happiness, but their feelings of worry, their feelings of fear, their feelings of stress, their feelings of love, whether they had a good day yesterday, whether they felt proud of what they did yesterday. So a very rich, nuanced sense of subjective well-being. It's not just a single question about happiness now. In some sense, you know, there's so many questions about subjective well-being. A different research method, ethnography, you sit down and talk to someone for an hour. In some sense, these surveys are doing that. But they're doing it for, you know, 100,000 people a year in 140 countries. So the international dimension of that, and then the richness of the many dimensions of happiness that we can now measure, these are two extraordinary things. And the third is the temporal dimension. Gallup in the United States are now in the field literally every day asking 1,000 Americans about their happiness. And it's absolutely fascinating. We saw, for instance, as Lehman crashed, so too did American happiness. In fact, American happiness declined before most of the economic indicators had declined. People could see forward. They saw grim times ahead. Well-being crashed. It actually started to recover over recent months. It becomes clear that we're certainly not facing the Great Depression. Certainly grim times, but not the Great Depression. So these different dimensions, it's just an absolute explosion of data, and we can do things today that were unimaginable even 5 years ago.
Justin, tell me about the Easterlin paradox. I mean, Richard Easterlin was one of the first happiness economists, I guess, and he came up with this paradox, which I'll ask you to explain. And it's something that you've come along with Betsy and said, well, hold on, we're not so sure about this. Tell me a little bit about this debate around, I guess the basic issue is, does more money make you happier?
Yeah, so the Easterlin paradox, you can think about it as simply being three facts. First, within any country at any point in time, it's absolutely true that rich people are happier than poor people. And that's been true in every survey ever taken. Second, Easterlin believed that if you compare poor countries and rich countries, there was no difference in the average levels of happiness. And third, Easterlin believed that if you compared a country through time, as it went from poor to rich, it didn't get happier. We spoke a moment ago about the explosion of data. So Betsy Stevenson and I went back in a Brookings paper and re-examined the Easterlin paradox. Now, I should say why the Easterlin paradox is important. The simplest way of reconciling the three facts is to posit that maybe what matters is not your level of income, but your level of income relative to others. or potentially relative to the past, some sort of reference dependent. That's really important. You know, average people call that keeping up with the Joneses. That's really important for economic policy, because if that were true, then policies that made a country richer also make the Joneses richer, and therefore they create no happiness. So economic growth is, as Gary Becker put it, a shell game. And so it has enormous policy implications. Before getting carried away with policy implications, let's go and figure out if it's true. So we went back and re-examined the three facts. First fact, yes, rich people in a country are happier than poor people within a country. Second fact, are rich countries happier than poor countries? Eastmoreland examined about a dozen countries, because that's all the countries we had data for in the mid-70s, and most of them were rich. If you want to figure out whether rich countries are happier than poor countries, you need to examine both rich and poor countries, not just rich and pretty rich. So now with these new Gallup data, 145 countries around the world, covering 95% of the world's population, it's absolutely clear that average incomes around the world explain an enormous amount of the variation in happiness. In fact, the correlation between the log of GDP and the average level of subjective well-being is about 0.8, which is just an unbelievably high number. Danny Kahneman concludes from this, and I think he's right, that it invites the inference that economic development may be one of the most powerful forces for raising levels of well-being. The third fact, or the third question in the Eastland paradox was, as countries get richer, do they get happier? And Eastland based this on the analysis of three data sets. The first was Japan. Japan is an extraordinary story. In post-war Japan, it's one of the only countries where the government was actually running happiness surveys. We got to see it from when it was very poor, post-war reconstruction, through to modern rich Japan today. And most researchers had concluded that Japan hadn't got happier through time. Betsy and I did something very simple. We retranslated the Japanese survey data and discovered that, in fact, the question kept changing. So happiness in Japan was rising throughout the entire period, but occasionally they changed the question and it would make it look like it was falling, and that's why others had erroneously concluded that happiness was flat in Japan. That's the first data point. Second data point, the United States. Since 1972, we have very good data on happiness from the General Social Survey. It looks like happiness has been flat, even as GDP growth has been reasonable. I think you can score this one for Eastland. It is true that the United States hasn't had much happiness growth while it's had economic growth. But I'm not sure the United States is actually that surprising. While GDP, which is a measure of what's happening to average income, has risen enormously, what's happened to the typical household is a very different story. Income inequality has grown an enormous amount. Most of that economic growth went to a very few at the very top end. So if most households weren't experiencing much economic growth, maybe it's not so surprising that most households didn't see their happiness grow. But that's just a conjecture. For now, the US will score that one as definitely for the Eastland paradox. And the third was Europe. There's very good data collected by the European Commission on happiness and life satisfaction since the mid-70s. And when Eastland originally looked at this in the mid-80s, it looked like life satisfaction measures hadn't grown even as Europe had. We've updated the data to today, and in 8 of the 9 countries which have been in the data the longest, happiness has grown as income has grown. The one exception is Belgium. That's a puzzle to us, but 8 of 9 go in the expected direction. And then the other thing is, through the World Value Surveys, we've now been able to measure changes in happiness approximately every decade since the 80s in a range of countries. And happiness has grown the fastest in those countries whose economies have grown the fastest. So again, that's more evidence linking growing happiness through time and growing income through time. And so that's the sense in which now we're led to one of two conclusions. Either it looks like growing an economy increases happiness, or if you wanted to take the more critical view, and I think there's some truth to this, the time series comparisons are hard to make, and maybe we'll need a little bit more data, but certainly there's no strong evidence of any paradox there.
Justin, you mentioned inequality in the US and perhaps the fact that a large proportion of the American population didn't benefit from economic growth, so therefore didn't get any happier. And your paper today was about the impact of inequality on happiness, looking across a whole range of countries. What do you think we know now? What have we learned from other research, and what have we learned from your research about how the inequality within a society affects the happiness of that society?
Yeah, there's a bunch of studies that look at, you know, the average happiness in a society, try and correlate it with the level of inequality. And the basic logic of any utilitarian says that, you know, more income to the very rich doesn't create as much happiness as more income to the very poor, so therefore more equality, more happiness. Previous researchers have looked at it, and honestly, the literature's a bit of a mess. Some people find that inequality leads to more happiness, some people find it leads to less, some people find it leads to no difference whatsoever. That has led some commentators to conclude that given that people haven't found a robust relationship between inequality and happiness, that inequality doesn't matter. And therefore, government shouldn't worry about inequality. So our paper, again, this is with Betsy Stevenson, we went back and we re-examined all the available data. Our conclusion is that it's difficult to isolate a clear relationship between inequality and happiness, but it's not because inequality doesn't matter. It turns out that there's just not much variation across countries in the amount of inequality. So if one wanted to figure out whether inequality mattered, one would need to compare a whole lot of countries with very little inequality with a whole lot of countries with a whole lot of inequality. And while there's some differences in inequality, they're not quite large enough, and so it turns out that a lot of what people were finding before is just statistical noise. So the intuition that many people had, that more equal societies are happier, we can't falsify that with the data. And the intuition that others had, that inequality doesn't matter at all, we can't falsify that with the data. So it's a very negative result. It just says, be careful about how you interpret these correlations. What's interesting here is not any particular finding, but actually the uncertainty around those findings. And the truth is, the data are wildly uncertain. And it's very hard to be confident about the effect of inequality on happiness. So the message then to consumers of this literature, you know, what should we do?
Absolutely, I was going to ask you, you know, what can we take from that? I mean, the worrying thing might be, presumably, that people will say, well, okay, we don't need to worry about inequality, because it's not going to have an effect.
Well,
we haven't got the evidence.
I think you want to think about what your prior is, based on whatever your theory is, and then just understand that the cross-country data can't be very informative. So don't allow yourself to be bullied by we empiricists into changing your mind a lot, because we empiricists just don't have enough data with enough variation that you should change your mind very much. So now you can take a bigger step back and you say, well, what should my prior be? If I think your posterior should be your prior, let's talk about how to think about a good prior. Well, it is absolutely clear when you look within any country that people at the very top, the extra happiness they get from an extra dollar isn't very much. People at the bottom really value an extra dollar a lot. That finding certainly suggests that inequality is a bad thing. It doesn't necessarily imply it, though. So my prior is that inequality is a bad thing. The data don't falsify that. Now, there are others who think that, you know, maybe inequality is a good thing. Take the United States, for example. Every cab driver somehow believes that their children could become the next Bill Gates. And so inequality, so those taxi drivers, it's a good thing, it creates dreams. You know, if you actually really hold that view, and you've got a theory, a model, a view, a mechanism, I don't think the data can talk you out of it, or not the aggregate cross-country data. So it is going to remain, I think, an open question, and probably remain an open question for some time to come, because we also thought about if there are other research designs rather than just comparing countries. Could we look at, say, comparing US states? Or could you compare changing inequality through time? And again, you get the same problem. There's just not enough ups and downs in inequality to figure out its effects. It's a basic econometric law. If you want to figure out the effect of something, you need to see some wiggles up and down to see if the outcome variable also wiggles up and down. And there's just not enough wiggles to figure it out.
In that context, looking more time series and cross-section, how about the impact of the financial crisis and the recession? I mean, are we going to be able to get data here that informs us more about the impact of these big economic and social impacts on people's lives?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is we have been tracking happiness and life satisfaction since the mid-70s in both Europe and the United States, and the most robust finding is that when the economy goes down, so does happiness. When the economy's up, so is happiness. And I should say, the effects are also large. The amount by which happiness falls during a recession is much larger than can be explained by the relatively small income falls during a recession. As bad as the current recession feels, average income, maybe, if it's dreadful, could fall by 5%. But happiness actually really plummets. And so we know that from that historic experience. The other thing is we now have, due to the daily Gallup data in the United States, daily data tracking a whole bunch of measures of happiness day by day during this crisis. And I think that's going to be the really fascinating thing, where we can try and figure out things like the role of expectations. There was a point where it was clear to people that the economy was going to go south, but it hadn't yet gone south. And so we can see what was happening to levels of worry, stress, fear, satisfaction, and so on. And so in order to learn anything in social science, you do need the lines to wiggle up and down. And so for a social scientist, a recession is a great time for business. It's a great time to figure out what moves up and down with the business side.
How much confidence do you think that policymakers, consumers of the happiness, the literature as you describe them, can take in actually implementing some policies, designing some policies and implementing them in response to the kind of findings that are coming out of the happiness economic research.
So I think some of them have fairly immediate policy impacts. For instance, there is this stylized fact that I think is absolutely clear: unemployment is a bad thing for happiness. Well, that of course suggests we should do what we can to reduce unemployment. That borders on the obvious. So I'm not sure that I want to give a great deal of credit to the happiness literature for suggesting that we try and avoid recessions. But it does say that unemployment is one of the critical indicators that we should pay a whole lot of attention to. There's also research comparing the consequences for happiness of inflation and unemployment. And so right now there's some debate how much more stimulus should there be? There's debate on both sides of the Atlantic. The happiness literature appears to tell us people care a whole heck of a lot about unemployment and a fair bit less about inflation. Maybe we should be erring on the side of being somewhat more expansion. I think the thing that I learned from all of this is the costs of mistakes, if those mistakes involve high unemployment, are enormous. And so maybe that gives a more dovish view to how one should read the business cycle. There's a bunch of other findings out there which one should always be careful interpreting any empirical study. So one can find that happiness is correlated with all sorts of things. I'm not sure I want to do a whole lot about it. For instance, happiness is negatively correlated with having kids. I don't think you should change your fertility behaviour based on that. It may well be the case that you're having kids for other reasons. Not to create happiness, but to create meaning. Now, maybe that suggests that those who are interested in doing research on subjective well-being should be out there measuring meaning. And actually, that would be a really useful thing to do. So one needs to be somewhat careful about this, I think.
And what do you think this idea discussed in some countries? I wouldn't imagine the States, but certainly in some European countries, of supplementing, or maybe in some cases even replacing the goal of government of raising or having a sustainable long-term rate of growth, measuring GDP, and replacing that with some kind of measure of gross domestic happiness.
It's not clear to me that it's that different from what governments do. Now, it depends who you're talking to within the government. If you're talking to the economists, they all think we're in the business of maximising growth. If you talk to a politician, I've never met a politician who said that his or her job was to maximise gross domestic product. They clearly have a more holistic view of the world. And so maybe, you know, a more holistic view of... Maybe what we're doing is we're adopting the lens that our policymakers are adopting, and that's perfectly appropriate for a positive social science. The other thing I should add is it's less clear today that they lead to different policy implications. So there was a time when everyone believed in the Eastlin paradox, believed that economic growth did not create more happiness, and so therefore believed that if you're in the business of maximising happiness, we should do something radically different. Certainly it would be a greener world. We might have a national hug policy. I'm not sure what it is, but certainly most of the leading bureaucrats would not be the people you and I recognise as major macroeconomists. When we realise that the level of GDP is so strongly correlated with the level of life satisfaction around the world, maybe it suggests that economic development is one of the leading pathways to greater levels of subjective well-being. In which case, my advice to groups like the World Bank or the IMF is, keep going. Maximising economic development appears to have a tremendous impact on human well-being.
Final question, Justice. Where do you see the happiness research program going? What's the agenda, I mean, generally and perhaps particularly for you?
I would be keen to see it come in closer contact with economic theory. And I think one of the things that that's then going to do is allow it to become much more quantitative. And I mean quantitative in the sense that when one hears about happiness research, one often hears about directions. Unemployment is bad. Marriage is good. Kids are bad. How good? How bad? How much? You know, what's the oomph? And I think that... That's then going to allow us to actually make a useful contribution and hopefully have a stronger interplay between economics and what's going on in the happiness research. For instance, the claim that that unemployment is bad, that ain't new. The claim that the effect of unemployment on human well-being is huge, that's important. That's a quantitative statement. And so I think it does mean going after some of the bigger policy questions around the world. And I think the explosion of new data, the ability of economists to start to, you know, understand the well-being consequences of economic policy. I think this is deeply economic. It's just going to be much larger than it's ever been before.
Justin Wolfers, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ramesh.